has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street, there by the Simmons Freeway. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by just a moment, please. Parkland Hospital, there has been a shooting. Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
Attention all squad, the suspect in the shooting at Elm in Houston is reported to be an unknown white male, approximately 30, slender build, height 5 feet 10 inches, weight 165 pounds, reported to be armed with what is thought to be a 30 caliber rifle.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Officer J.D. Tippett, 38 years of age, was killed today.
The entire area has been blocked out, no one allowed in or out, as the search for this would-be presidential assassin continues in downtown Dallas.
The Dallas Police Department arrested a 24-year-old man, Lee H. Oswald, in connection with the slaying of a Dallas policeman, J.D. Tippett, shortly after President Kennedy was assassinated.
Here comes Oswald down the hall again.
You fire that rifle.
That's as fast as you people have been given, but I emphatically deny these charges.
Did you kill the president?
No, I have not been charged with that. In fact, nobody has said that to me yet. The first thing I heard about it was when the newspaper reporters in the hall asked me that question.
You shoot the president?
I work in that building.
Were you in the building at the time?
Naturally, if I work in that building, yes, sir.
Back up, man.
Did you shoot the president?
No, they're taking me in because of the fact that I live in Missouri.
What time is it?
I'm just a patsy.
The president?
Chief, do you have any concern for the safety of your prisoner?
No. I don't think that the people will try to take the prisoner away from us.
We went out by Captain Prince. There is the president. There is Leon Wall.
He's been shot. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot. Well, there's a man with a gun. Absolute panic. Absolute panic here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Detectives have their guns drawn. Oswald has been shot. There is no question about it. Oswald has been shot.
Mr. Oswald died at 1:07 our time in the operating room of the gunshot wound which he had received.
Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. In our new series on the podcast where we answer listeners' questions that get emailed in to me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com, this week our questions come from David in Rochester, New York. David asks, when witnesses were brought into the Dallas Police Department to try to identify Lee Harvey Oswald as the killer of Officer J.D. Tippett, how fair were the police lineups? And then he says, I read somewhere where there were threats made on Lee Harvey Oswald's life before he was gunned down by Jack Ruby. Is that true? So let's tackle David's first question. Were the police lineups fair that Oswald appeared in? In a typical police lineup, an individual suspected of a crime is presented along with other individuals of similar gender, complexion, height, build, and age. The victims or eyewitnesses of the crime are then asked to identify the criminal. The results of such a lineup are confirmed to a level that can count as evidence at trial. Again, the suspect, along with several other individuals, stand both facing and in profile, allowing identifiers nearly every possible angle to identify the correct perpetrator. This is sometimes done in a special room, which includes details like a height measurement grade on the wall to aid identifying the person's height. The person making the identification views from behind a one-way mirror or similar protection to guarantee obscurity and safety for the witness. If the victim or witness successfully identifies a suspect from among the fillers, the identification is considered valid. What is a filler? Fillers are people who are included in a police lineup with a suspect to help determine if the suspect is the perpetrator of the crime. Fillers are often actors, volunteers, or prisoners who are similar in height, build, and complexion to the suspect. For evidence from a lineup to be admissible in court, the lineup itself must be conducted fairly. The police may not say or do anything that persuades the witness to identify the suspect that they prefer. This includes loading the lineup with people who look very dissimilar to the suspect. With this contextual information, we will now examine the lineups used that weekend in Dallas while Lee Harvey Oswald was in custody. Oswald was placed in four different lineups that weekend at the police station, three on Friday and one on Saturday. The three other participants in the first two lineups were Dallas police employees, unmarked by bruises and dressed in business attire. William Perry and Richard Clark were detectives in the Vice Division, and Don Abels was a clerk in the jail. Detective L.C. Graves told the Warren Commission that the way fillers were usually selected for lineups was that the Homicide Division would call down to the jail office, tell them which prisoner they wanted to show, and ask them to provide two to four other prisoners who were the approximate age and size as the prisoners they were showing. However, in the first and second lineup, this was not the way that fillers were selected. Rather, William Perry testified that Captain Fritz called the Vice Unit, not the jail, and requested two officers. Perry's partner, Clark, confirmed it was Fritz who made the request. Detective Jim Lavelle testified that the Dallas police, quote, didn't normally, end quote, use police officers in lineups. Fritz testified that he borrowed those officers because he feared other prisoners would harm Oswald and that we didn't have an officer in the office the right size to show with him, so I asked two of the special service officers if they would help me. Less than 4 hours later, however, at the 7:55 p.m. lineup on Friday night, Oswald was handcuffed to two other prisoners. In Saturday's lineup, all of the fillers were prisoners. So much for fearing for Oswald's safety. As I mentioned earlier, the fillers for the first two police lineups were not dressed as close as possible to Oswald, as in normal procedure. Jim Lavelle would state, quote, I know in all cases we would usually try and have them dressed alike as possible, the same as each other, end quote. Captain Frizz testified that the three police fillers took off their coats and neckties and fixed themselves where they would look like prisoners, and were not dressed any better than Oswald. When questioned by the Warren Commission, one filler, Detective William Perry, testified that he put on a brown sports coat for both lineups. A second filler, Detective Clark, testified that he was wearing a white short sleeve shirt and a dark sports coat for both lineups. He also testified that he got the dark sports coat and that Perry got the brown sports coat from the homicide office. In other words, it seems like these two fillers were specifically directed to stand out from the suspect as much as possible during the lineup. Don Abels also testified that he was wearing a white button-down short-sleeve shirt with checkers for both lineups. Detective Elmer Boyd admitted under oath that the three police employees were dressed much more formally than Oswald, as he was wearing a white, blood-stained, stretched-out t-shirt in both lineups. Captain Fritz just flat-out lied to the Warren Commission when he testified that the police officers fixed themselves where they would look like prisoners. Prisoners don't wear sports coats. Furthermore, it's unlikely that Fritz mistakenly remembered or was told misinformation, for he reported that he was present at the first lineup for Helen Markham, and Detective Clark testified that those items of clothing were taken from the Dallas Homicide Office. Dallas Detective L.C. Graves states, quote, Let me say this, that it would be very unusual and unlikely if we had a lineup and if they put anything other than men that fit the approximate size, weight, and age in there with them, because we just don't operate that way. but in this case, things were done differently, and I don't know why, end quote. In addition to providing dissimilar fillers, witnesses were told that the perpetrator was in the lineups. In his testimony, William Calloway, the cab driver, quoted what Detective Jim Lavelle told him, Sam Ginyard, and Cecil McWaters before they viewed the second police lineup with the police department fillers. Quote, we went into the room. There was Jim Lavelle, the detective, Sam Ginyard, and then this bus driver and myself. Jim told us, quote, when I show you these guys, be sure and take your time. See if you can make a positive identification. We want to be sure. We want to try to wrap him up real tight on killing this officer. We think he is the same one that shot the president. But if we can wrap him up real tight on killing the police officer, we have got him for both murders, end quote. So now on to lineups 3 and 4. So far, David, do you think they were done fairly? As if stacking the police department employees as fillers in the first two lineups was not enough, the Dallas police put two blonde teenagers in a lineup with Oswald and Abels for the third lineup. In this lineup, the witnesses, Barbara and Virginia Davis, described the man they saw running across their lawn as a white male, slender, light complexion with either light brown or black hair. However, both fillers, Richard Brochgard and Ellis Brazil, had blonde hair and ruddy complexions. In his testimony, taxicab driver William Scoggins also described the murderer of Tippett as a white male, light complexion, 25 to 26 years of age, medium height and weight, with either medium brown or dark hair. However, one filler for the fourth lineup, John Thurman Horn, was 17, and filler David Edmund Knapp was 18. The final filler for the fourth lineup was Daniel Lujan, a 26-year-old Mexican man of thicker build, at 5'8 and 170 pounds. The testimony from the hearings indicate that the Dallas police had a procedure for selection of fillers in their lineups. The testimony also shows that the police deviated from the procedure for the first two lineups because there was no one, quote, the right size to show with Oswald. Police then solved this dilemma by putting fillers in the lineups who not only deviated from the descriptions given by the witnesses, but also deviated from Oswald's appearance. They put well-dressed detectives, blonde teenagers, and men of differing race in the lineup. It should come as no surprise that the results of these lineups would prove highly suspect. The purpose for the selection of these fillers was to ensure that Oswald was the only one who even came close to the description of the killer, making him the only choice possible. Lacking any conclusive evidence, they sought evidence via police lineups that they could use as reference in trial. I've said many times on this podcast that I've had the absolute pleasure to work alongside and get to know some of the great researchers in this case, many of whom helped open doors for me in my research that I could not have opened myself. One of those was the late great, and I do mean great, Larry Harris. Larry was on the board of directors of the Assassination Archives and Research Center in Washington, D.C. He was also the founder of the JFK Assassination Center in Dallas. Larry's mission was to force the government to release all material relating to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Larry's life was unfortunately cut short when he died in a car accident on October 4, 1996. Here's a piece Larry did about the Oswald lineups on the men who killed Kennedy. We miss you, Larry.
Oswald was placed in four different lineups, three on Friday, a fourth on Saturday. In the first two lineups, Oswald appeared with two police detectives and a jail clerk. These men were wearing clothing quite a bit nicer than Oswald, but moreover, they did not resemble Oswald in appearance. They were heavier, older. One of them had blonde hair. The police gave fictitious names and occupations. Oswald gave his real name, his real occupation, the Texas School Book Depository. This information was being widely disseminated even by the time of the first lineup. In the second and third lineups, Oswald appeared with men who were quite a bit heavier, older. Some of them had blonde hair. And in the fourth lineup, which was the most outrageous of all, Oswald appeared in the lineup with two teenagers and a Mexican. And in the second, third, and fourth lineups, Oswald complained bitterly to police about the manner in which the lineups were being conducted. And he berated the police, demanded legal representation, and it was very, very apparent to any witnesses that Oswald was the suspect. There are established criteria for the fair and proper conduct of police lineups. By any stretch of the imagination, every rule in the book was violated by the Dallas police in the conduct of each of the four lineups that weekend.
Now to David's second question of the day. Were there threats made on Oswald's life while he was in the Dallas jail? Dallas police officer Billy Grammer says he tried to alert the police chief to information that could have prevented the death of Lee Harvey Oswald and the secrets that went with him to the grave. As the nation mourned the assassination of our 35th president, Grammer and the rest of the Dallas Police Department began working long hours. Grammer was in his office in the dispatch division the night after the assassination. That's when he got a visit from someone he knew, nightclub owner Jack Ruby, who was considered a friend of the police. Ruby was often at the police station, including that night after Kennedy's assassination. Quote, "He was just like he always was," Grammer says of his hour-long talk over coffee with Ruby. "He never once mentioned Oswald," end quote. Oswald was still locked up at the station. Later that night, after Ruby left, Grammer got a phone call from someone refusing to give his name. Quote, "It sounded like Jack Ruby, but I don't know. He started telling me about, if we don't change the plans, we're going to kill Oswald in the basement," end quote. The Dallas police had made it public that Oswald was going to be transferred to the county jail by armored vehicle. What the public did not know was that the armored vehicle was a decoy. Oswald would be hidden and transferred in another vehicle. Quote, "This guy that called knew all about that, and he told me about it," end quote, Grammer said of his surprise. He got a fellow high-ranking officer to listen in on the phone. He then typed up a report and gave it to Police Chief Jesse Curry. Quote, "Chief picked it up and looked at it for maybe 10 seconds, end quote, Grammer says. Curry would then say, quote, "There's nothing to that," and laid it back down. We said okay and we walked out. Grammer says the department was getting lots of calls threatening to kill Oswald, but Grammer had a bad feeling about the call he got. Quote, "I remember when I got home Sunday morning, I told my wife, somebody's going to kill Oswald in the basement of the city hall this morning, and she kind of laughed about it a little bit," end quote. Hours later, she woke him up to the news. Quote, "I got up and went in and the TV was on. The first person I saw was Jack Ruby, and I thought, oh my, I knew this was going to happen," end quote. Grammer says Chief Curry told FBI investigators the next day that he did not remember getting Billy's report, but Grammer says his fellow officer and two FBI agents stood behind him. Quote, "That report has never surfaced," Grammer says. When all that happened on Sunday and Oswald was killed, I think probably Sunday afternoon the chief probably shredded that thing and threw it in the trash, end quote, Grammer says.
Billy Grammer was a police communications officer on duty the night before Ruby killed Oswald. Around 9 p.m., he received an urgent message from a caller who refused to identify himself.
I thought I recognized the voice, but at the same time, I could not put a face or a name with the voice. And as we talked, he began telling me that we needed to change the plans on moving Oswald from the basement, that he knew of the plans to make the move, and if we did not make a change, the statement he made precisely was, "We are going to kill him."
Billy Grammer reported the call, finished his shift, and went home to bed. The first Billy Grammer knew of the slaying was the following morning when he switched on his television set.
No sooner than I turned it on and they were telling that Jack Ruby had killed Oswald, then I suddenly realized, you know, knowing Jack Ruby the way I did, this was the man I was talking to on the phone last night. At that time, I put the voice with the face, and I knew within myself that Jack Ruby is the one that made that call to me the night before. And I think it was obvious because he knew me and I knew him, and he called me by name over the telephone. And seeing this and knowing what I knew and what he had said, then to me it had to be Jack Ruby.
So to answer your second question, David, were the threats made against Oswald's life while he was in jail? That answer is yes. Now there's a lot more to that, but we'll save that for another episode. Hope we answered your questions. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon. Or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. Also this week, I'd like to announce that I'll be speaking at the Citizens Against Political Assassinations, or otherwise known as CAPA, conference in Dallas in November. If you'd like to get a signed copy of my book or just meet and talk about the case, I'd love to see you there in November. The conference runs from Friday, November 22nd to Sunday, November 24th. I will be speaking about my book, The End of Innocence. And also, I'll be speaking about the presence of professional assassins in Dealey Plaza the day President Kennedy was killed. I'll also be speaking about a second arrest in the Texas Theater that day. You could get tickets for the conference at www.capa-us.org. Hope to see you there.